Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, the credit card fast. Fasting is a controversial topic when it comes to food and can be difficult to pull off. How about putting your credit card away altogether? Lisa Semilonis is a single mother of a couple of kids from New Jersey who used this method after her divorce. She's here to tell us how it works and her journey to gaining financial freedom. Then if you're someone who lives paycheck to paycheck, getting access to your pay earlier instead of waiting a whole 2 weeks can seem like a solution. Now there are platforms that are making this possible. One of them is called Ceridian. It's a human resources software company. It has something called Dayforce Wallet, which is an on-demand pay platform. Aaron Fox, their VP of operations, is going to talk about how it works. And the pandemic affected all of us in one way or another. Darren Goldman called it a retirement fire drill. Goldman is a senior portfolio manager at Goldman Wealth at Raymond James. He's here to talk about what we can learn from COVID-19 when it comes to retirement. Plus, we all know that drafting your will is so, so important. Considering your kid's RESP account in the process is something that is often missed. Daniel Goldgut, co-founder and CEO of Epilogue Wills, is here to tell us what to do to ensure that all is in order. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Let's get started. If you are feeling the pinch financially, waiting 2 weeks for payday can be a really, really big challenge. There are now some new options as a workaround there. There are these on-demand pay platforms that can make it possible to get paid earlier. One of them comes from a company called Ceridian. They are a human resources software company. They launched something called Dayforce Wallet, which is an on-demand pay platform available to employers here in Canada. And we're going to talk to Aaron Fox, Vice President of Commercial Operations at Ceridian, to hear more about how this works. He's in Fairfield, Connecticut. Hello there, Aaron.
Hello, Bruce. It's so nice to be here.
Thank you for joining us. What exactly is an on-demand pay platform?
On-demand pay is getting paid immediately after you work. So if you're an hourly employee, you finish your shift. If you're a salaried employee, you finish your day. And the wages for those days are presented to you in an application. Then you have the choice. You can bring forward some to all of those wages in advance of the traditional pay period. So in short, what's happening is the traditional pay period, which is usually 2 weeks, bi-monthly or monthly, has been replaced with something much faster. And this is a benefit that employers are offering to their employees.
And why is it a benefit? What is the advantage to the employee?
To the employee, it's often a financial wellness tool, but it really empowers employees in so many other ways. They've been empowered and they've given things so much faster and more immediate. But it's really best thought of as a financial wellness tool, because if you think about it, employees and really people need something like this to better manage their financial lives. The Canadian Payroll Association talks about 1 to 3 Canadians living paycheck to paycheck. The same association talks about Canadians not being able to come up with $1,000 in a pinch if they were to need it. So the way that this offers them financial wellness is it allows them to bring forward wages if they need to put something on their credit card, for example. They can avoid doing that and avoid interest-bearing forms of debt. And there's also a benefit of just simply knowing it's there. I'm sure, Bruce, you feel the same way as I do, that just knowing that there's a financial backing in your life gives you a sense of security and allows you to reduce stress, which is so often caused by financial stress.
What are the cons? What are the cons of giving an employee access to money as it is earned?
We don't see many cons. There certainly are probably some people out there who would better manage money if it was given to them only on a bi-weekly or bi-monthly basis. But, you know, those people have the option to manage their money as they do today. Many employers raise these kind of concerns and they come from a really good place. But the data that we have shows us that this is not leading people to manage their money in a less optimal way. The data that we see shows that people are using this for everyday purchases everyday spending patterns. And it's really the feedback we hear is it's really giving them a sense of security that they would like to have if their employer offered this to them.
Well, and I'm glad you referenced data because you have it and I don't. But I will tell you the concern that I have is that less frequent pay periods typically enable people to develop the skill around budgeting, some of which, you know, some people who develop that skill and some don't. But the reason it's so important is that they pay their cell phone once a month. They pay their rent or their mortgage mostly, not entirely, but mostly once a month. Their utility bills are once a month. So if they get access to money on a shorter term basis, when it comes to those big lumpy expenses, they may not have enough.
Well, what if they could pay those bills faster? You know, what if they weren't leaving those bills for every month, as you say, or every 2 weeks, as you say? The data that we show, as I mentioned before, shows that people are taking about $110, which has been remarkably consistent over the 3 years we've been doing this in North America. They're taking 5 to 6 on-demand pay requests per pay period. And when we see at an aggregate level their spending patterns, which is just about all we can see from a privacy standpoint, they're so consistent. It's supermarkets, gasoline stations, fast food establishments, and eating places, as they're called. They're using this to float their day-to-day expenses. And we believe that's helping them with their overall financial life.
When you say $110, is that per each time, 5 times 110, or is it 510 over the or 110 over the course of a month?
It's $110, 5 to 6 times requested per month.
Gotcha. So it could be $550 over the course of a month. Maybe your gross take-home pay is $2,000 or $3,000. So it is certainly not, people are not trying to withdraw the lion's share of their salary.
They're not. And look, more anecdotally, Bruce, we have over 850 customers in North America that are live that have made this benefit available to their employees. And we have not had one come back to me and say, I need to turn this off because the feedback I'm getting from my employees is that this is putting them in a worse place than they were before. It's just not something we see. And as I mentioned before, with the spending patterns, what we do see is they are taking that $110 5 to 6 times per month, but they're using it on expenses that they need on a day-to-day basis. And what we hope to see as well is that they're avoiding putting things on their credit card, getting into a further debt trap, and even using something like payday loans, which 70% of low-income Canadians do. So we hope that those things are helping their financial life. And that is the feedback that we get back.
And I think, you know, from where I sit, the big opportunity here is with the segment of the population that does rely on a payday loan, because the rates are ridiculous if you have to go that route.
I feel comfortable saying I would love this to be a disruptor of that industry. And I think sounds like you agree too.
Yeah.
That would be a wonderful thing if we can use something like this to reduce the dependency on those things. But I will say that we do see a lot of hourly employees using this, those that fit the description that you just provided, but we also see salaried employees too. Salaried employees, particularly those that live in major urban areas, do often live paycheck to paycheck. And even those that don't, we hear several points of feedback from employees that say, I like to use this as a place to help myself budget. I advance some of my wages here, even though I'm a salaried employee, I set them aside, and we're creating tools in the application that would also enable them to have that experience.
And they can only access funds that they have earned. So there is no way to get an advance.
I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to respond to that. Yes, and that is a key distinguisher of our product, Dayforce Wallet. Our killer application at Ceridian is that we have a continuous calculation engine running in the background for all employees that receive our pay. We're running gross to net calculations that are fully compliant. And when we offer wages to an employee, or they request them more specifically, we're treating it like a compliant payday. So we've already set aside any flat financial obligation that they need to pay, and we've calculated taxes on whatever they've earned at that point in the pay period. So what they're being presented in the app is net pay. This is your take-home pay. And if they choose to take that, they're only taking from that amount itself.
Demographically, it is younger employees who are using this. What's your insight as to why that is? I have some hypotheses. What are yours?
The younger employee seeks experiences in their professional life that resemble those in their personal life. And another way of saying what I just said is things that are on demand, things that are more immediate. For an employee who is maybe of a Gen Z population, the idea of waiting every 2 weeks to get paid is so out of step with the way they're living the rest of their lives. So I think that's one of the reasons that we see it's skewing towards younger employees, but I wouldn't necessarily say that we're entirely in that demographic. We certainly have a variety of use cases and people using this.
There, I can hear in the way you speak, there is a layer of behavioral finance that informs this process, and I think to the good. The other area of behavioral finance that is connected is around saving. And of course, the seminal work done by Thaler on Save More Tomorrow. What's the other side of this? So if you're enabling spending that is grounded in behavioral finance, how can you use Dayforce Wallet and your technology to help those employees behave in a way that serves their future self from a saving perspective?
We're thinking a lot about that specifically, and a feature that we will roll out in the United States shortly, and we'll have a fast follow in Canada, will be a savings feature within the application, which effectively serves like a side account. So an employee can set a goal and say, I'd like to save towards a holiday. I'd like to save towards a birthday gift to my child. And then we will track their progress towards that. And by visualizing their pay and taking that immediately from what's available to them in net, they can more effectively track towards that goal, have the experience of tracking towards it, and see how that accumulates over time. And I think that's one way we're doing that.
What is the 5 to 10 year look of the pay platforms that you run? Where are we headed? I mean, this was not a glimmer in the eye of the employee 3 years ago. You've obviously been focused on it for probably longer than that. But what else could we expect as we look to the future? And I love that I'm asking this question because I think for most people, they cannot think of a more boring thing, innovation in the payment space. Given what you do and given what I do, I'm like, oh, yeah, like what else is going to happen? This is exciting. What else are you working on?
I laugh because I speak at payroll conferences, and we have to acknowledge that. We have to acknowledge that there hasn't been much innovation in this space. But look, where are we going to be in 5 years? I think a couple of things. I think this will be a normalized way to pay. The only reason we're really paying this way is because we didn't have the technology to do it. We needed 2 weeks to process things, to be accurate, to be compliant. We don't need that anymore because we have tech. And I think employers are recognizing that, and they'll begin to offer this as a standard way of pay. So I think it will seem odd in 5 years from now to have a 2 week pay period, or at least not have the optionality to do this. I think you'll see increased features within these applications that make employees more excited to use them and give employers maybe opportunities to communicate with their employees through this mechanism in a whole new way. For us here at Ceridian, we'll continue to add exciting features and we'll continue to go global. We just launched 4 weeks ago about in the United Kingdom, and we have our eyes on other markets as well. So I think this will be global. I think it will be more common, and I think there will be more experience embedded within these applications than there are today.
Really interesting stuff. Aaron, thank you for joining us today.
It is absolutely my pleasure.
Aaron Fox is Vice President of Commercial Operations at Ceridian, and he was here to talk about on-demand pay platforms. And I will say, don't tell Aaron this, but he did reduce some of the concern that I have about instant gratification and an employee's inability to pay for the bigger things. Because that's not what we're currently seeing. So we'll see. Coming up next on Moolala, I'll speak to Lisa Samalonis, a woman who went on a credit card fast to help her get her finances in order and eventually buy her own home. And later, RESPs and wills. Daniel Goldgut from Epilogue Wills tells us how to factor that RESP into your estate plan. If you have missed an episode of Moolah La, you can head on over to moolahla.ca, listen to past episodes. You can search by name, by topic, or you can go to any of the podcast platforms out there, Spotify, Stitcher, Amazon Prime, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. You can download the show, write a review, or even subscribe to the next episode so it will arrive right on your device.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Welcome back. Moolah La, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit. As I said, the counseling is free and judgment free. Can you imagine your life without a credit card? Like just literally not using your credit card? That is what my next guest did in order to get a handle on her finances and buy a home. Lisa Somalonis went on a credit card fast to help her get out of debt and buy her home. She joins us now to talk about her journey and share some tips on how you could do it too. Lisa is in Blackwood, New Jersey. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. How are you today?
I am great. First of all, tell us a bit about your life prior to this fast. What was going on for you?
Sure. So I had been married for about 13 years. And as many couples do, we got into debt, and it was a financial strain for us. There was a variety of factors, but our marriage ended. And I decided that I wanted a different life for myself and wanted to make a fresh start. And so once we got divorced and sold our house, we cleared out all the debt that we had. And I kind of vowed to myself that I didn't want to ever get to that place again. And I also didn't quite trust myself in the beginning to make good choices.
Where did the idea come from to do a credit card fast? I mean, millions of people want to get a handle on their credit card spending. Not millions of people would choose that approach.
Sure. So I guess from our previous experience of kind of running up some of our credit, I was, like I said, not really trusting myself. So I felt like I wanted to go back to the basics. And just to be fully transparent, I read a lot of different personal finance things, different philosophies. And, you know, I didn't agree with all of them, but I took out from each one things that worked for me. And one of those things was limiting credit cards. You know, they're not evil, but for me, I felt that it was a good thing for me to do this fast or take a break from it, because then I could look at what I was spending in real time. And I felt like I had more control. If I didn't have the cash and I didn't have it in my debit account, I just couldn't use it.
So how did this work? Did you cancel the cards, or did you freeze them in a block of ice? What did you do?
None of those things. Although I've read about people who've done all of those things. And for me, I just really, it was a mental decision. You know, you made these mistakes before. You don't want to make them again. Let's not use them unless it's like really, really dire. And so, you know, I just had an awareness of what was coming in, what I knew I needed to spend for bills. And then the irregular expenses is sometimes what trips people up. And you feel like, oh, I don't have this money, so I have to put it on my credit card. So I tried to really start looking at everything in real time and then planning ahead if I knew something was coming, like, say, a quarterly bill.
What were some of the challenges that you had to overcome, either practically, like, you know, some expenses come and you got no option, or emotionally, habits that you had to unwind for yourself? Or, I don't know, a lot of people have a sense of entitlement, seems like a big word. I don't mean entitlement, but that they feel like they deserve to have presents to wrap for the kids on the holidays. Those
sure. Oh, absolutely. And those were the kinds of things that I would plan for. I also reached out to I had a good support system. So sometimes if there were things like, say, for Christmas that we wanted, maybe people would ask me, what should I get the kids? I would tell them. And sometimes it was practical things like, you know, we need new sneakers for cross country or things like that. But I think I try to get into a gratefulness state of mind. Like I do have a lot of blessings in my life. Mm-hmm. So we focused on that. We had our basic needs met. And then when things came up, we just tried to almost became like a game. Like, how can we do this? One thing was a small thing, but eating out, especially as a single parent, sometimes you run out of time. Mm-hmm. You haven't planned for a meal or something like that. And like when the kids were small, we would go to fast food a lot. Mm-hmm. And like that would rack up after a while. And so we started to do like breakfast for dinner because that was easy for me and quick and cheap. And it could be fun, you know, sometimes. So like, that was just like a little thing. But yeah, so just trying to be disciplined. Also, I needed to make some more money. Like when you look at everything and you see what your income is coming in and what is going out, sometimes you realize, I have to do something else. Now, luckily for me, I could always be I'm a freelance writer, so I could do some freelance writing and editing, and that helped. Although you have to wait to get paid. You don't, you do the work, you don't get paid the next day. So again, it's more planning.
How hard a trade-off was that for you to make I assume sacrifice time and energy for your self-care, for your kids, in order to say, no, I actually need to take on other assignments in order to make the finances work.
Right. So it did give me a sense of control, though, that I was, I had made this commitment to myself and that I felt lucky that I could actually make some more money. But you're right. It is a time constraint. Sometimes I did it after the kids went to bed or on the weekends, maybe, when they weren't here at an activity. But it worked out. And also when you do the side hustle or the freelance, you kind of can control what you take on. Mm-hmm. So that's also important.
You write about giving yourself some grace.
Yes.
What did that mean for you?
For me, that was a big part of it. I'm a high achiever. I call myself a reformed perfectionist. I made some mistakes. We made some mistakes when we were married. I made some mistakes on my own. And I sometimes would be self-critical, and that doesn't really help. We all make mistakes, we make missteps, and if we're self-critical, that just kind of is a negative energy, and I wanted to put my energy into something positive going forward. So I tried to think about what I wanted my life to be, and then from there, made some positive steps towards that.
Our listeners will I'm going to oversimplify here, but they'll have one of two reactions to the choice that you made and to your story. One may be, I'm inspired, I could do it too. The other could be, I could never do that. Mm-hmm. To that second group, what would you say?
Well, I think I would say that this is not a permanent state. I did not cancel any of my credit cards. I wanted to preserve my credit score. And I didn't freeze them or anything like that. But I did this for a period of time, probably about 3 years, until I felt confident that I could make my bills, the payments, that I could plan ahead, that I had that discipline. And then I did go back to using credit cards. I use a zero-based budgeting app. I use the You Need a Budget, but there is some other free options as well. I think maybe Every Dollar, I think it's called. And so then, and also the envelope method, if people still use all cash, so that you can kind of, I trained myself, I feel like, to go back to use more responsibly. And, that was just a personal choice for me. And at the end of each month, I know that I've set aside all the money that I've charged so that when the bill comes due, I can pay the entire statement balance, not just what is due. So that's a system that works for me. And I think it can work for other people.
Sure. If your kids were here and I were to ask them about this time, what would they say?
My kids are 22 and 25 now, mm-hmm. and we've had this conversation, and they're very sweet and they're very proud that we made it work, because as a single parent, I tried to foster a team environment. So we were all on the same team. I don't think that they felt deprived in any way. I think, sometimes we made choices, but I always said, this is where we're choosing to spend our money, not we can't afford it. So it was empowering. And now in their 20s, I really am an advocate for them to manage their own money. They are using the zero-based budgeting system as well, with very, you know,
young people.
Yes. And it's very hard. You know, my younger son will say to me, the only thing this budget tells me is that I don't have enough money. And then he gets angry. Right. And I'm like, okay, well, that can be a motivating thing. Maybe we need to make some more money. Maybe we need to look at where we're spending our money. So it's been a good experience overall.
Just as we wrap up, in the dark days, and I know we're talking for 10 minutes, but in the toughest times, the darkest days of this, especially because your context was coming out of a marriage and, you know, being on your own,
right?
What was the thing that kept you going, that had you stay focused on this fast and stay focused on getting a handle on your money?
That's a great question. I think there were a couple of things. One was that I had a vision for what I wanted our family life to be in the future, and that was secure and peaceful. Mm-hmm. So I felt that these efforts were helping me get there. And then I kept a diet of reading all of the personal finance and blogs and, podcasts like your show. And that really kind of helped me keep on track. And then finally just thought, I'm so blessed with what I have. And that kind of just, you know, I don't need that thing because I have what I need already. So kind of like that abundance mindset.
So great. Lisa, thank you for joining us today.
No, thank you so much for having me.
Appreciate it. It was great to meet you. Lisa Samalonis went on a credit card fast following the end of her marriage. She got her finances on track, bought a home, and I think did a pretty darn good job parenting kids in a way to live with financial well-being in mind. Thanks again, Lisa.
Thank you.
Hi, it's me, your dad. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Coming up later, I'll speak to Daniel Goldgut about why you should factor your kids' RESP into your will. But first, Darren Coleman is here to talk about how COVID-19 impacted our ideas of retirement. He called it a retirement fire drill. I'm the money columnist for CBC Radio. Every Wednesday, we look at a topic relevant to you and your financial life. So perhaps we can meet there too.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
A retirement fire drill. That is how my next guest describes one aspect of the pandemic. Darren Coleman, Senior Portfolio Manager at Coleman Wealth at Raymond James. He joins us now from Oakville, Ontario, with this, I don't know, refreshing take, empowering take on what was a horrendous couple of years. Darren, when you say a retirement fire drill as it relates to the pandemic, what do you mean?
Well, I think the whole experience really began, I call it like a weird reverse camping trip, you know, like you were stuck on your campsite, you couldn't go anywhere, and you were not entirely sure you had enough toilet paper. So that's, I think, how it began for most of us. But as we began going through the experience, which lasted longer than I think anyone expected it to, it really did become like a fire drill. So if you think about what a fire drill is, it's an exercise that's kind of forced upon us to see and test how well are we prepared for an emergency or something that might be coming. And I look at this idea of it being a fire drill for retirement, because retirement is in many ways about, you now have more time on your hands, your circle around you might get a little smaller, work is changing. So there's a lot of lessons I think we all learned as a result of COVID, that if we think about them consciously, if we're mindful of how our lives adapted and adjusted, I think that can actually make for a vastly better retirement experience. And I also believe that this whole concept of retirement is very much changed, partially by the boomers, but I think also by this experience that we went through together, because everyone went through the same thing, but we all experienced it incredibly differently.
You were quoted in an article in Forbes near the beginning of the pandemic and talked about the problem, it was phrased as a problem, of having too much time. What did you mean then?
Well, we were suddenly forced to do things that maybe we hadn't thought about. You couldn't just go to the mall. I mean, you know, in Ontario, where we are, we were probably the most locked down jurisdiction in North America, where we weren't really allowed to leave unless you had to buy groceries or walk your dog. That was about it. So we were now stuck, if you will, at home. And what do we do? And one of the things that was advantageous for me was getting to know Dr. Joe Coughlin at the Age Lab at MIT. And they're doing all this work about how retirement is not really retirement anymore. It's all about longevity. And they've got three questions that they ask of us to see how well prepared are we for retirement. And those three questions really, I think, set up really good metaphors for how prepared are we. So the first one is, how do you change your light bulbs? How will you change your light bulbs? So that's really the idea around how will you look after those day-to-day tasks in your life? You know, when you're 87, you probably shouldn't be on your ladder changing the light bulbs. Yeah. The next one is, who will I have lunch with? So how will I maintain my social groups if I don't have the ability to go out and see them, or if my social groups get a bit smaller? And then the final one is, how do I go out and get an ice cream, which is all about mobility? How do I get to the things that I want, or can I bring the things to me? And so from our perspective as advisors, I've really paid attention to those three concepts as they've manifested themselves through the period of time where we really couldn't go anywhere.
There were so many hot takes, so many views about what would change as a result of the pandemic, which, as you say, went on much longer than anybody expected. What didn't change? As you reflect 3 years later, you go back to that article, and it really was in the early weeks. What hasn't changed about retirement?
Well, I think the fact that people aren't prepared for it is still the true, right? Mm-hmm. I think the fact that people underestimate how long it's going to last and how much it's going to cost, and the impact on your social relationships, on your business relationships, on just how are you going to spend all those extra hours and all that extra life you're going to live? I think people are still not prepared for that. That hasn't changed. I've done this as a financial advisor for 30 years, and it still surprises me at how surprised people are, you know, that they're living longer than they thought. They're living more actively than they thought. And, you know, when I started in this industry 30 years ago, when I met with someone in their 70s, they were old, like think Golden Girls old, like they were children of the Depression. They were teens and adults during World War II. They were the great generation. And today, if you're 75, you're probably still doing 10Ks and buying racing.
Oh yeah, kayaks. You're crushing me at pickleball. If you're
70. Exactly right. Uh-huh. So it's a fundamentally different human I'm talking to in so many ways. And I think that surprises people how active and vital they remain as they get older, providing their health still stays well.
One of the things that I think all of us saw in various ways was how we returned to our life as things opened up again, and what we chose to do and what we chose not to do. Bring that to the conversation on to our conversation about retirement, because when you talk about the fire drill, we had this reset, and for those of us who are going to work for decades to come, we did make different choices on how we would work, how we would socialize, how we would develop business, all those sorts of things, which is a change that a retiree would need to make, but just maybe later in life.
Absolutely. So this is why I say it is a fire drill, because that change was now forced upon us before maybe many of us were ready for it. And retirement also tends to sneak up on people, right? Many people are not ready for it despite the changing of the calendar, even though they know when they're turning 60 or 65 or whatever their date is, it still surprises them when they get there. So here we had it forced upon so many of us. And I would argue that anyone who did a financial plan or thought about their future in 2018, nope, none of that is probably accurate anymore. That's all gone out the window. And I think the pandemic forced us to really reconsider what was important to us. What were the things that we were going to go back to when we were allowed to go back to them? What became a priority? Maybe what wasn't a priority anymore? And what relationships did that all got stress tested, right? So what relationships did I really miss and I want to go back to? And then I'm sure all of us have people in our lives that, maybe I don't really need to hang out with them anymore.
Right. You know? Preferably it's not your spouse or your kids or your parents.
Well, certainly all happened, right? They all these things happen. And I think the other element that we also have to be mindful of is how do we look after our parents and other people the generation ahead of us? Because many families discovered wow, we don't really have a great circle of care around mom or dad. So that became a big priority. And that goes back to the changing the light bulbs. How are we going to help? I may be okay to change my light. What about mom? And do they have enough food? What's their health care like? What's their mental health like? How do I look after them when I can't get to them? And things like technology and services have certainly adapted to enable a lot of these things that weren't there or were there, but in their infancy just a few years ago. And I think most of us probably had a Zoom party with friends. I had one with kids I went to elementary school with. Somebody decided to host this thing. And that was, I mean, we all looked like our parents, which was very strange on the Zoom call. But I don't think we would have done that if it hadn't have been for this experience.
Right. I want to weave in the financial aspect here, because I think your metaphor is apt when it comes to investments in retirement, in that there was a sudden and significant decline in the stock market that would have people go, oh my God, I'm not going to be able to retire.
Yeah.
And then, of course, that's not the way it worked out over the course of time. And markets have proven to be quite resilient. How would you, what learning would you reflect on as you think about the financial aspect?
Yeah, that's a great point, Bruce, because that's another fire drill that we all had. And I think anyone that was paying attention even slightly got an abject lesson. And here's what you need to do to invest. Investing isn't all that hard. It's predicting the future that's hard. And that's what causes most of the problems. Everybody gets caught up in thinking what might happen next. But if you just maintained a disciplined approach through all of that and ignored the news, you were fine. But we had that wicked volatility that came in really sharply as the world seemed to, like, we don't know what's going on. And then the response by governments and central bankers was also surprising. And none of that was very easily predicted, obviously. And so if you just did nothing and didn't even open your statements and you just maintained a reasonably well-balanced portfolio, you were fine at the end of that. And I think, and then we saw kind of a repeat of that again in 2022, of back down the other way. Now it's coming back up again. So I think the lesson investors ought to take from that is, maybe I should just mind my own behavior and not touch the portfolio so much.
Right. I'd love it if that was the learning. Because as you say, you've been around a long time. I've been around a long time. So we have seen the dot-com boom and bust, the financial crisis, like all these things where if you just did nothing, you were awesome. It was the people who didn't do nothing that had a harder time.
There's a very old adage in our industry, which I'm surprised people forget. So I'll remind everybody that your investment portfolio is like a bar of soap. The more you touch it, the smaller it gets.
Right.
And that remains, I heard that 30 years ago, that remains to be true today. It's always that way.
On the fire drill, the other thing that people experienced was different needs and wants in terms of a sense of place. And we've seen, and it's anecdotal, but I think it probably plays out in the data too, that many people either look for a second home, or they move to a smaller community, or they bought a bigger home because they realized, geez, if these people are going to be around all the time, I better have a space to crawl away and hide. What of that trend has proved to be sustained over time? And what has unwound as we realize, actually, our job is going to require us to go into the office sometimes?
Yeah, I'm sure there's a few people that decided to move, you know, in Ontario, that I decided to move up north and just thought I can be a remote worker or move south. And maybe I didn't have the freedom I thought when the boss says I need to come back into the office. And I think that's actually something that employers are struggling with too, is that people made very different life decisions. And as we've seen, the employment market has been very, very tight. The employment numbers have been far better than anyone anticipated. Like the numbers we saw in January in Canada were 10 times better than estimated. So those are not small misses. Like the employment situation is very robust. So if you're an employer and you demand your staff come back to work, if they choose not to, they can get another job pretty easily. So it's interesting how people's decisions to put where I wish to live and have my lifestyle, now that I don't need to commute anymore, have really moved that power balance around a little bit. So certainly there's some people that went, oh, geez, maybe I got ahead of myself. Others are like, no, this, I don't want to commute. And I've done that in my business. We were on Bay Street for 30 years and we decided, yeah, we don't really need to do this anymore. Because what's the point of going downtown to just be on Zoom all the time?
Yeah. Yeah.
Why don't we just remote home? So the technology has really enabled, I think, people to have more control if they have that opportunity. And many are seeking it and using it.
I just want to ask you one last question as we wrap up here. So in, again, to this metaphor of the fire drill, one of the things that you realize if you were to do one at home is, oh, geez, where are my important documents? Where's the fireproof safe that I will know where it is as the smoke alarm goes off? I run down and grab that one suitcase and race out of my home. So you learn that. The drill teaches you that. Is there anything else you would say we were taught about retirement by the pandemic?
So I think you're exactly right. You know, where your documents are, and that's something we take our clients through. It's like, okay, boom, someone doesn't come home today and cause of death or illness, not relevant. Maybe you tripped and fell or got hit by a Chinese weather balloon. Doesn't matter. Where's your documents? And people often think about wills and power of attorney. Obviously those are critical, but how do we get into your phone? Like, what's your password for your online banking? How do we turn off your Facebook account? Like, how do we do that? And people, I think, need to be guided through that by someone to give them some clarity and insight.
You do realize you just conflated retirement and death just there, right?
Well,
that was not the question I asked. I said the retirement fire drill, not the death fire drill.
Well, if we're going to do a fire drill, there's a reason we're doing it, because it is serious, right?
Sure.
So those are elements of it. I think the other component of this that we have to be mindful of is, what were your assumptions? What did you think you were, and what of those things have changed? And now you're probably more you than you've ever been. And so take advantage of that. Take advantage of the fact that you do get a bit of a reset, and to make changes and act positively towards what those changes are.
Really interesting stuff. Darren, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Bruce.
Darren Coleman, Senior Portfolio Manager at Coleman Wealth at Raymond James. He joined us to talk about the retirement fire drill that was that little thing called the pandemic. Coming up, what you need to do to ensure your RESP account continues in the event of your death. Daniel Goldgut from Epilogue takes us through the process when you're drafting your will. And you can stay up to date on all things Moolala by signing up for our newsletter. It's got all the things that we've done on this show, CBC Radio, CityLine, BNN, Bloomberg, all that. Just go to moolala.ca.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Money and kids. When it comes to creating an estate plan, one of the things that's kind of important is RESPs, if you're saving for a kid's education, but they are often left out of the process. And there are some things that you actually should know to ensure that that RESP can continue in the event of your death. Woo! Jazzy fun topic. To talk about some of the considerations that you need to make and things that you need to think about, we're joined by Daniel Goldgut. He is the co-founder and CEO of Epilogue Wills. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce.
If you do nothing specific in your will, so you're a parent, you've set up these RESPs for your kid, if you do nothing specific in your will, what happens to your kid's RESP?
So if you do nothing, there are some consequences, which is that the money in that account will go to your estate. And one of the consequences of that is that the tax benefits are lost. So all the hard work that you did in setting up that account and having that money available for your children for their education, that money goes into your estate. And some of the benefits that you were hoping to get by setting it up in the first place are gone.
Now, when you say the tax benefits, are you talking tax or are you talking about the government grant?
So more the government grant, but there are some tax implications as well, in that the money that is sitting in your RESP is growing tax-free. So you're right, there is a government grant that they give to help support your effort to save for your children's education. Mm. And the money that's sitting in that account grows tax-free, and there can be some clawback, so to speak, if that money ends up in your estate and not going towards education.
So Daniel, just to be clear, the government contributes 20%, that maxes out on an annual basis, it maxes out on a lifetime of something like $7,200 or so. Are you saying that that could get clawed back?
That's exactly what I'm saying.
What if I am married? Does the RESP, can my spouse be the subscriber to that RESP?
Yes. So it's a good point. So oftentimes when spouses set up an RESP, they'll do it jointly, where both of the spouses are subscribers to the plan, which means that when the first spouse passes away, the surviving spouse continues to be a subscriber of the plan. And so that money does not go into the residue of anyone's estate at that time. So very common to do it that way. And so what needs to happen is, because we don't know in what order people will pass, if each person makes a provision in their will that if they are the surviving subscriber, that things will be dealt with.
Okay, so we've said here are the risks. There are challenges here. As someone is doing their will, what are the specifics that need to happen to reduce the risks?
So it's actually pretty simple, which is that you can include a provision in your will that names a successor subscriber. So oftentimes that can be the executor of your estate. That same person, you can give that person the role of being the successor subscriber, which means that they can continue to make contributions and they can keep that money available for the beneficiaries. And just doing that, including it in your will, preserves those benefits.
Epilogue is an online platform. I've gone through it. You and I have spoken in the past. And one of the things that's really helpful about it and other online will providers is that it prompts you. So it's harder for things to get left out because you're kind of forced to answer these questions. On Epilogue, is there a prompt here? Will it not allow me to move on if I've said I've got kids and I haven't done taken the appropriate action on the RESP?
So we ask one question earlier in the process that just asks, do you have a registered education savings plan in place for your children or anyone else? And if someone answers that question as yes, then later we ask, do you want to give your executor the ability to manage your RESP after your death? And what we've seen is that putting it in front of people in that way, almost everybody chooses yes. There's no real downside of choosing no. And so once it's presented, on Epilogue, it's two clicks, it's two simple yeses. And then when the document comes out, it includes the necessary language.
I think this is a really important distinction here to reinforce that it is, it's the subscriber's money. It goes in the subscriber's estate, because how we talk about the RESP in our family is that it's not my money, that it's my child's money. But you're saying in practice, that's not accurate, that it rolls up to my estate.
That's right. If it remains in the RESP, then yes, it will go out to that.
So I could lord that over my child in a much more effective way than I have in the past. Jeez, I'm going to have to change my parenting style on that. heaven forbid, this is an appropriate question, but it's a worrying one for every parent. What happens if the beneficiary dies? So you've got one kid and you lose that kid before they access the full sum of that RESP. What happens to those funds?
So there are some rules in the world of RESPs that would deal with that. And, you know, a similar thing, if that child decides not to pursue education that the RESP is set out to provide for. So there are rules about what happens, and essentially that money sort of makes its way back into the hands of the subscriber. And there are certainly some, not penalties, that's probably the wrong term, but similar to as what we said before, a clawback where sort of those full benefits aren't realized.
Obviously, for people who have children, one of the biggest concerns that we have is the well-being of our children after we pass, in particular when they're younger, but certainly as we're older as well. What are the other parts of this process as it relates to our kids that we really need to think about as we're developing the estate plan?
So I'll focus on two in particular. One is guardianship, and then the second is the distribution of assets. So when it comes to guardianship, as you mentioned, having kids is a real motivator for people to making their wills and completing their estate plans. But when they get to this question about who should be the guardian of their minor children, it's a stumbling block. It's really hard to picture anyone else in that role. And so often people get to that question and then they're not really sure what to do. But naming a guardian is very, very important, because that has is a very strong factor that a court will look at in deciding who should take care of your minor children. So even if it feels like there's no perfect choice, it's better to do something, leave someone's name there that you trust, and you can change it over time. So it might be that at this point in your life, if you're, you know, you've got young kids, that your parents who are still relatively young might be a good fit for that role to take care of your young kids. But maybe 5 years from now, 10 years from now, your parents are a little bit older and they're not the best choice anymore. And at that point, you look around and say, okay, who might be the best choice now? Also, you might know more about your kids once they're 5, 7, 10, 12 in terms of who they are and what they like and where the best fit would be. So guardianship, very important and pretty straightforward to do. And then the second one I'll mention is the distribution of assets. So when you're leaving money to a minor, it's important that that money is held in a trust, right? No one is paying out a sum of money to a five-year-old or a 10-year-old. That money gets held in trust until that child reaches a specific age. So using a platform like Epilogue, you can decide what that age is. So you might think that at 18, you would be comfortable with them receiving their inheritance, or 21 or 25 or some later age than that. And in those trusts, it's important to know that oftentimes the trust is set up in a way that the trustee of the trust, the person who is actually managing the funds, can distribute some money earlier than that final age that you set, if it's for, you know, health or education, support, things of that nature.
Just before we go here, we have had this conversation. I have had 14,852 conversations about the importance of wills. We have not moved the needle one single percentage point in terms of the number of adult Canadians who have not completed this step. What is the single most important message that you would communicate to incent people, motivate people, cajole people to doing this piece of paperwork?
You've asked for one, but I'm going to give you two.
Okay.
And I hope that that's okay.
Totally fine.
So the first is that this really is an important thing to do for the people that you leave behind, for your family and friends. I had a discussion with someone recently who knows that this is sort of the area that I'm in, who said that her father-in-law had passed away without a will, and that they were now into, you know, year 4 or 5 of trying to sort of tie up all of these loose ends. And it really impacted the way that they feel about this person, their memory of this person. And so the simple act of creating a will can be so powerful in that it leaves that important lasting legacy to your family and friends that you did this for them. That's the first part. The second part is that it's actually not so hard to do. And so if that first part is meaningful to you, and you understand now that there are some ways that you can get this done, and it doesn't have to take so much time or cost so much money or be so difficult, put those two things together. Hopefully that can help to start moving that needle.
Really, really helpful stuff, Daniel. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us today.
Absolutely. Thank you, Bruce.
Daniel Goldgut is the co-founder and CEO of Epilogue Wills. And we were talking about one particular aspect of your will often overlooked, and that is what to do about a registered education saving plan that you've got for your kid, how to make sure that that works and is funded and is available for your kids in the event of your death. That's it for our show today. A thank you to our sponsors, Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. To get in touch with us with your comments, your questions, your story ideas, your feedback, your whatever, our email address is ask@moolala.ca. ask@moolala.ca. You can subscribe to our newsletter at moolala.ca. Subscribe to the podcast on any of the podcast platforms out there. On social media, I'm at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. Thank you for listening and have a great day.